This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Actually intervene domestically and put down large-scale social movements demanding change. So that's really what is at work here in terms of the domestic surveillance programs.
In terms of the surveillance of Muslims and mosques, I wonder if you could speak to the, I don't know if the word is irony, perhaps timing, that at a time when many are disturbed by widespread domestic spying, they seem to have lost interest in domestic spying on this particular population. Why do you think that is? I think you've touched on this a bit already.
Absolutely. This is actually what I argue in my book, Islamophobia and the Politics of Empire, which is that powerful nations always need an enemy, and one that is so powerful an enemy that domestic populations can be frightened into accepting the policies, whether these are domestic policies like the spying program or foreign policy, because people are kept scared. And, you know, I can compare this to the Cold War, for instance, as we were taught to be frightened of the Red Menace, whether it was the Soviet Union or Reds right here in our midst. I mean, there may be people in your audience who are old enough to remember the school drills, right, where people were asked to duck underneath their desks in preparation for a nuclear attack. What was the point of that? The point is to keep people scared so as to allow U.S. foreign policy and domestic policy, particularly spying on the civil rights movement activists, people like Martin Luther King and so on and so forth, to carry on. And that's exactly what we're seeing today, is this sort of overarching Islamic terrorist enemy has been created to keep the American population scared as a way to police domestic dissent and to continue the U.S.'s adventures around the world, whether these are drone strikes, whether these are special operations to execute people around the world and so forth. This is the logic of Islamophobia and the creation of this Muslim enemy.
We've been speaking with Deepa Kumar, a professor of media and Middle Eastern studies at Rutgers and the author of Islamophobia and the Politics of Empire. Deepa Kumar, thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you so much, and thank you for the important work you do.
The time is 6:02. You're listening to KBOO Portland. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing and Full Circle Resale, hosting its 29th annual anniversary celebration, June 14th through June 23rd. Specializing in 100% natural fiber clothing, Gazelle and Full Circle Resale are both located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont, and at GazelleNaturalFiberClothing.com, fiber is F-I-B-R-E, or FullCircleResalePortland.com. Up next, Bread and Roses.
At the dawn of the day, all the darkened kitchens, the mill of grey, all touched by the radiance that the sun discloses. Oh, hear the people singing bread and roses.
Next, we bring you Feminist Current Events from WINGS, Women's International News Gathering Service. Feminist activists are petitioning the Australian government to keep Tyler the Creator out of the country. Are his lyrics artful or just hate speech?
You're listening to Feminist Current, making waves in the mainstream.
Let me clear space for your
Welcome to Feminist Current. I'm your host, Megan Murphy. Rapper Tyler, the Creator, brings misogyny to a whole new level in his lyrics. We aren't talking about just obscenity here. We're talking about rape fantasies and murder fantasies. While Tyler, the Creator, and Odd Future, the hip-hop collective he's a part of, may claim that this is either art or satire, it's difficult to see how rapping about raping and killing women is either funny or defensible on account of it being supposedly art. When the Australian feminist activist group Collective Shout learned Tyler, the Creator, would be touring in Australia, they petitioned the government. Talitha Stone is among those calling on Immigration Minister Brendan O'Connor to revoke his visa. I spoke with her recently from her home in Australia. Here's that interview. So, I mean, first of all, I wonder if you can just tell me a little bit about Tyler, the Creator, and how he came onto your radar.
Yeah, of course. Well, I am a member of the organization Collective Shout, and so we had a tip-off the week before Tyler was due to come to Australia, just saying, look, this is a man who's coming into the country. This is what he promotes. These are his lyrics. These are all of the venues he's going to be performing at in Australia. And there are also a number of all-age concerts. So with all that information, that's when together myself and Collective Shout decided to take action to try to get his visa revoked.
And so you and Collective Shout, which is a feminist activist group, petitioned to have his Australian visa revoked. So yes. Why did you do that?
Because the type of messages that he promoted, we didn't want someone like that in our country promoting that kind of violence and those kind of attitudes towards women, when as a country we have many campaigns about violence against women, and especially with the White Ribbon, like their slogan is "Violence against women, Australia says no." And as a member of this country, I take that very seriously. And if there's someone like that coming into our country, then I wanted to take action to make sure that our government would act on what they've told us is their values about women in this country.
And what is it about his lyrics in particular that are so bad that you would have to take these measures? You know, like a lot of hip-hop is sexist. I mean, there's a lot of sexist music out there in general, but there is, unfortunately, a lot of misogyny in hip-hop. But what are your concerns with regard to his work in particular? You know, what are the kinds of things that he's promoting?
He promotes raping a woman, murdering her, then having sex with her dead corpse. And then he also talks about locking her up in his basement. He talks about raping a pregnant woman and calling it a threesome. Like, it's absolutely horrific. And then, like, the song that he even dedicated to me, like, some of the lyrics in that, he says, "Punch a bitch in her mouth just for talking shit." Like, it's so much, goes so much deeper than just these lyrics. And I think from what the evidence I got, what I filmed, is proof that he's inciting his fans to act upon these lyrics. So it's not just a song, and it's not fictional like a lot of people have been arguing, when a girl was sexually assaulted at the event that I was at.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
How did you find out about that?
Because I went to the police after the event and they did a report, and that police officer who I was with, his colleague, was attending to the girl who was sexually assaulted.
So what's happened since you started doing this? So since you decided to petition to have his visa revoked, you know, how has he reacted?
Well, he retweeted me, so that's how the whole thing started. My tweet was very tame. All I mentioned was that he needed educating in misogyny, and I just mentioned the fact that maybe there should be a protest at his Sydney thing, at the Sydney signing. And because of that, he then retweeted me to 1.7 million fans for longer than 24 hours. It's still going now. I'm receiving rape threats online, and that's when I first went to the police. They didn't do anything about it. And then after the show, I went to another police station, and that's where they did the report, and like still following up with them about like new evidence of more threats that I've been receiving. But unfortunately, because Tyler didn't use my name, he just said that bitch who's trying to get me kicked out of the country, they couldn't do anything about it. If he had said Talitha, they would have been able to charge him.
And what you filmed at the concert, you mentioned you filmed a show of his recently. What happened there?
I filmed him calling me out to the crowd, saying that that bitch is trying to get me kicked out of the country. This song is directly to you. I hope that your children get some messed up STDs. And then the language kept going, like a lot more explicit that I'm not really comfortable with repeating. Mm-hmm. And he did that twice throughout the show. For two different songs he dedicated to me. One song was called Bitch Suck Dick. And the whole crowd was pumping their fists and encouraging him and cheering along with him. And at that point, like, my heart was pounding because I was there amongst that crowd. And I'm so glad that no one knew that it was me that was amongst that crowd, because I had thousands of his followers who obviously would fight to their death to defend Tyler. And I've seen that online of people who would do anything to keep defending Tyler.
It's really horrific.
Yes, it has been.
Yeah, like, so what has this experience been like for you? I mean,
it's been mixed emotions. I've received so much support from people, like, all over the world. It's been so, so encouraging and quite overwhelming, but I've been so disappointed with our own government. Only one MP has acted on this, and that was my local MP for the Hills District area, Alex Hawke, and he's called on Julia Gillard to act upon it. And this was before I even attended the show. This is at the very beginning stages of it. And we've still had silence from our government. We've had silence from White Ribbon, like organisations that have a massive, like, they're all about protecting women and fighting for women who have been victims of rape. And I can't understand how, when this has gone global and there's been so much attention around it all, and they still remain silent about it. It's shocking. I don't understand it. It doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, so how can people support you, and how can people sort of join the petitioning of the government? What are the next steps here?
Well, Collective Shout, where I have a website that people can join, because ultimately that's what we need. We need support. I mean, we only have one person who's paid, and the rest of us are volunteering. Like, we're trying to do as much as we can, but without funds and without support, there's only so much we can do. Like, everyone's exhausted from even just this one campaign. And so I guess we just need individuals who will speak out against this and not remain silent. I'm just one person who spoke out against it, and look at the impact it's had. If more people are doing that, oh my goodness, we'll see radical changes. We just need those people who have been affected by it to keep speaking out against it. And I don't know, it's quite disheartening about the way our government's responded to this, but I need people to not let that affect them, and regardless, continue to speak out against these kind of things.
Mm-hmm. Are you asking people to contact the government, or what would you suggest people do if they want to help you to continue petitioning the government against Tyler, the Creator?
I think that would help if more people do contact the government. Like, on Collective Shout, we have contacts that people can email or call, like in Parliament and stuff. So we do. I think that would help. The more people who make noise about this. I mean, the government can't ignore everyone. The government can't ignore thousands of Australians who are raising their voices. So I hope that more people will speak out and our government will listen.
Mm-hmm. And what's the Collective Shout website so people can go there?
It's collectiveshout.org.
Great. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me. And I really, you know, thanks for speaking out about this. I'm so glad that I found out about this through Collective Shout. And I'm just really disgusted by the whole thing. It's really, really gross. The reaction from the fans, his words, everything. I just can't believe it. So
it's scary.
Yeah.
It's very scary.
So I'm grateful that you and Collective Shout are trying to address this, and I hope that we can get some more support for you all.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate you getting in contact with me as well about this.
You just heard an interview with Talitha Stone, a member of Collective Shout, which is a grassroots campaigning movement against the objectification of women and sexualization of girls in media, advertising, and popular culture. Please visit their website, collectiveshout.org, to learn more about how to support their work. Up next, I wanted to air some clips from a conversation that happened around hip-hop and holding artists accountable for sexist lyrics. The conversation was hosted by Mark Lamont Hill and took place on Huffington Post Live in April between hip-hop artist Talib Kweli, Ebony Magazine's News and Life editor Jamila Lemieux, Washington Post columnist Rahel Tesfamerian, and activist Rosa Clemente. They discussed the controversy surrounding some of Rick Ross's lyrics on the song UOENO that were said to glorify rape culture, as well as the question of whether or not calling out misogynist lyrics in hip-hop counts as censorship or limits artistic freedom. Here's that conversation.
It's good to have you on the show. We've been talking about hip-hop lyrics and sort of what it means for us to police them to a certain extent. Do we have a responsibility to, say, challenge a Lil Wayne when he says, I'm a beat pussy up like Emmett Till? Or is there space for that kind of artistry in our community?
Well, one, you know, I don't believe in condemning or censoring any art. I definitely believe in challenging it and challenging our artists to be more responsible in their lyrics. But too often with hip-hop, we have an incredible double standard where we accept it from rappers we like and don't accept it from rappers we don't like. And I think if we're going to challenge the artists, it's an empty challenge when we challenge the artists all the time and wipe our hands clean, but don't challenge ourselves, don't challenge our education system, don't challenge our parents, and don't challenge each other. When we place the blame squarely on the shoulders of artists, I think that's dismissive of how great the problem is. I don't think lyrics ever are the root causes of the problems, only the symptoms of the problems. And I think that if we want to change what these artists are talking about, we need to change the community that these artists are drawing inspiration from.
That's an interesting point. What do you all say to that, Rosa? Push back.
Well, not pushing back as much as we have to do both, okay? Like, the problem within, again, like, I don't really consider personally Rick Ross or Lil Wayne part of hip-hop culture. And that could be my rigid standard. But that's the standard I'm going to stand behind, right? Mm-hmm. So in saying that, that puts me on a whole different radical perspective than some of the most progressive people in hip-hop. Because I think some things are sacred in our culture. You don't got cats rapping about the Holocaust, right? And making fun of that too much. Mm-hmm. And I think that speaks to just how we have to view lyrics as well. Look.
Now see, Rosa.
Hold on 1 second, Rosa. Let Tyler push back, because I was going to push back on that point, too. Go ahead.
I completely and totally disagree. And I think that that's part of the problem. The moment that you say, I don't consider them part of hip-hop culture, then why should they listen to you? Why should they care about anything you have to say? They are part of
hip-hop
culture.
Because I don't see hip-hop. I don't see industry really representing hip-hop culture. I see artists who are rappers.
But they are part of hip-hop culture. They are part of hip-hop culture, whether you... They are part of hip-hop culture whether you think they are or not. That's just a fact.
Okay, so if they are part of it, then I'll say this. Then they do have a responsibility not to be rapping at 40 years old about date rape. You know,
and
that's the problem right now.
I agree with that totally. But if we want to change them, then the smarter play, and we want to change them, then the smarter play is to embrace them with love. If you tell somebody, fuck you, you ain't a part of hip-hop culture, you're a monster, you're destroying the culture, and you should listen to me.
None of us have said that.
But you are saying that when you say they're not a part of hip-hop culture.
I don't want to get hung up on the
first thing you started with. I don't want to debate someone like Talib Kweli who has done amazing work.
Rosa, hold on 1 second.
That's not my premise here.
But hold on.
Everybody hold on for 1 second, because I want to make sure the audience stays with y'all.
I joined this conversation to say this, is that the first thing, Rosa, the first thing you said, when they brought this up was, first of all, I don't consider them a part of hip-hop culture. That's
right.
Condemning them.
And
that's excluding
I explained
them.
Why.
But hold on. Whether your opinion is that you personally don't feel like they are part of hip hop culture. One is not true. They are part of hip hop culture. They are, whether you feel like they are or not. And two, if you're starting your process of trying to change the way that they rap by saying I'm dismissive of your efforts entirely, then why would they listen to you? They have no reason to listen to you. The only reason, we have to embrace people with love. None of these people are evil. None of these people are evil trying to bring down our community on purpose. They're misguided the same as their fans. I don't care if Rick Ross is 40 years old. He's a misguided 40-year-old person. You know, and when we embrace them, we have to embrace them with love. Like, everything everyone's saying about that line is correct. Rick Ross condoned rape in that song, and he shouldn't, and he should apologize. And his apology that he offered was unacceptable. His apology that he offered was dodged the issue and leads us to believe that either he's naive or he's just stupid.
All right,
I would like to believe.
Second,
I would like to. I don't think that's.
Hold on one second, because I want to catch the audience up. We only talked about Lil Wayne. I want to catch everybody up out there about what we're talking about with regard to Rick Ross. Rick Ross recently put out a song. He was on a guest, doing a guest verse on a song, and the lyric actually went, "Put Molly all in her champagne. She ain't even know it. I took her home and I enjoyed that. She ain't even know it." All right. The idea being that he slipped something in her drink, and then he took her home and had sex with her. Since then. Rick Ross has attempted to respond to it. It was, for me, one of the most underwhelming apologies that we've seen in recent history. Can we show Rick Ross's response to this?
I want to make sure this is clear, that woman is the most precious gift known to man.
Right, right.
You understand? And it was a misunderstanding with a lyric,
right,
a misinterpretation where, you know, the term rape wasn't used. And, you know, I would never use the term rape.
Right.
You know, in my records and as far as my camp, hip-hop don't condone that. Streets don't condone
right.
that.
Right, right.
Nobody condones that.
I want to go to you, Jamila, and then Rahel, because I'm hearing the conversation. I want to move the conversation forward just a little bit. Let's concede for a minute that all of these artists that we've mentioned so far, particularly Lil Wayne and Rick Ross, are part of hip-hop. And I understand the distinction that Rose is raising, and I don't want us to get hung there, and I respect Rose's position on that, even if we ultimately disagree. But if we're saying that they're all within a broader cultural and certainly racial community, how do we deal with a Rick Ross who makes a lyric like that? And then for all intents and purposes, really doesn't apologize for it. He says, I didn't say rape. He says it's a misunderstanding. Yet he never says who misunderstood what, how we could have otherwise interpreted, put something in her champagne. She ain't even know it. I took it home and enjoyed that. I mean, so how do we respond to that? How do we deal with that? And is that fundamentally different than Lil Wayne, who's making a clever play on words in his mind on Emmett Till, or like Kanye did with Emmett Till? Is there a difference? And if so, how do we deal with that difference?
There's a difference because of the things that they said were different. But I think that both lines really do speak to rape culture in hip hop and Black culture in American culture. You know, a lot of what we criticize about hip hop, we tend to make it Black specific or ghetto specific or male specific. It's just an American problem. Okay, so you have white men, you have white male politicians that have said things that are very similar to what Rick Ross said. You know, so it's not to say that hip hop is the problem. Like, you know, I do agree with Talib that hip hop is not the root cause. We're seeing broken, misguided people with a huge global platform speaking to and from the place of being damaged, speaking to damaged people about their own damage. I'm not as loving for anyone who did see my article on Ebony.com. I did say F Rick Ross, and it's not just because he's 40. It's because I've had, you know, longstanding issues with him and what he represents as a member of the hip hop community. But, you know, I do understand that speaking to him with love, which I think is the responsibility of people like Talib, you all can have a conversation that I can't have, you know, as peers, as artists. I'm not a rapper. I'm not as vested in hip hop as other people. I'm more vested in Black people. But and that's why I respond to a rapper like Quali, because I see that he's vested in both hip hop and Black people.
I totally hear you, Jamila. I guess what I'm wondering, though, is if we start from the premise also that hip hop is not an exclusive place for rape culture and that rape culture is not indigenous to hip hop culture, then we do hip hop a disservice? Is it unfair to hip hop for us to heap a disproportionate amount of critique and blame? And certainly we do, right? I mean, when we could look throughout pop culture and see rape stuff everywhere, but hip-hop seems to be getting more of it. Ashley Judd came out last year and said hip-hop right. has a rape culture. She didn't say pop culture has a rape culture. She didn't say right. sports has a rape culture. She said hip-hop has a rape culture. Rahel, if we do that, is it unfair to hip-hop? Do we suddenly create a sense of pathology around hip-hop that's unfair?
What's unfair about hip-hop is the fact that there's this one-sided image of masculinity that Rick Ross and Lil Wayne in some ways begin to represent all black men because those are the dominant voices in hip hop. So I think a large part of it is my concern of how masses of young African-American and Latino men have their conceptions of relationships and sexuality and masculinity shaped by these artists that they may be listening to all the time. And so it has a lot to do with the fact that there isn't balance. I mean, you might hear a Talib track, but the Rick Ross and the Lil Wayne's of the world are going to always drown that out because they have their pulse on radio stations, on television, and music videos.
That's an interesting point. Kweli, one of the things Jamila just mentioned was this idea that peer-to-peer, there's a space for critique. Do you feel comfortable going to other artists and saying, look, even what you just said right now, which is that Rick Ross was wrong and should apologize, would you feel comfortable saying that to Rick Ross?
I have no problem saying that to Rick Ross, but I have no problem saying that to Rick Ross because I'm approaching him with love. I'm like, listen, you are a part of this culture. You have a beautiful contribution. You, Lil Wayne, Drake, whoever people want to diss, y'all all can contribute beautifully to this culture. And I, you know, it's like that's if I didn't love them, I wouldn't care. If I didn't love them, I would be dismissive. I have to say that the reason why I had to say Rick Ross was wrong in that situation, why I feel like he was wrong, and I said it on my Twitter, and I said it again now, is because I claim to represent hip hop culture. I can't claim to represent hip hop culture and then shirk away from the issues. But at the same time, if I'm calling him a monster, if I'm coming at him automatically like, yo, you have nothing to offer this, then I'm just as bad. And we can't approach it like that. And I think that all of us should. I don't think it's just on me as an artist. All of us should approach it like that. You know, like I really do feel like that.
There was an interesting conversation between you and Lupe Fiasco yesterday about the power of hip hop and of lyrics in particular to produce certain kinds of social realities and outcomes. You know, do lyrics actually cause people to do certain things? Does music actually cause?
No, they don't. They're no more than video games do. And that's an excuse that politicians use. Lupe Fiasco grew up listening to gangster rap. He said it on his Twitter. He said, I grew up listening to Spice One and Beethoven. Well, guess what? Both Spice One and Beethoven make up Lupe Fiasco. No one could just listen to positive music. It's yin and yang. You need a balance. Do I think saying that you're going to slip a girl a Molly in the lyric and take advantage of her is taking it too far? Hell yeah, that's taking it too far. And us as hip-hop, we need to stand up and say, yo, homie, like Rick Ross said in his apology, the streets don't condone that. I'm saying, look, the streets don't condone that apology. It wasn't good enough. That apology didn't deal with the issues. But at the same time, I'm hoping that you come back and make a record about it. I'm hoping that you come back and add to it. Imagine if Tupac and Biggie didn't get killed at 25 years old. Imagine what they would grow into if we allowed them the possibilities. My argument with Lupe ended with a simple word. It ended with, not argument, but debate, with the word condemnation and the word evil. He felt like we should condemn evil things in hip-hop. I don't believe Rick Ross is inherently evil. I don't believe Chief Keef is inherently evil. I don't believe Lil Wayne is inherently evil. I don't believe these people are evil. I don't believe we should condemn them. I believe we should criticize, we should discuss, we should express our disappointment, and we should not support when they come with things that are not worth supporting. But we should welcome them into this culture and welcome them to change. Too often, we base our judgments based on region and emotion. They're not making the type of hip-hop we like. Biggie Smalls had rape lyrics. Eminem had rape lyrics. You know, but we forgive them because they make type of hip-hop we claim to like, real hip-hop or underground hip-hop. We should call all rappers to task on the same level.
That's an interesting point, Rosa.
That's part of what feminists have been doing in this culture for over 25 years. And the thing
right,
is that I think that
right.
Talib is right. And when he pushed back on me having this strict definition with hip hop, and I'm down to take that critique, you know, and I think that's important that we can have this debate. And I think it's only in a place of hip hop can we have these debates and not debate each other as people, but debate ideas. Now, listen, when I dropped the Rick Ross response, My thing was, at this point, I don't really care about the industry in terms of putting all my energy into targeting that aspect. My concern was, first, when are men finally going to stand up against this with us? There's not a time in hip hop where something has affected a black man that you have not seen black and brown women joining that fight. And what we're saying as women is that we're trying to attack this rape culture, whether it's Rick Ross, whether it's Steubenville, whether it's Odd Future, whether it was Too Short 18 months ago, that this is part of something that's been building. I think Rick Ross has become the tipping point. So I'm more... I'm not ready to say, Rick Ross, I love you and I embrace you. But I'm ready to say that we need brothers who are his peers, not only to say that to him, but to stand up against rape culture. Because I was talking to an educator yesterday and I asked him, do you think this stuff influenced kids? And he says, we don't put all of it on the influence of the lyric. But you have to understand, to young people growing up, that sometimes these are commands and become blueprints for their behavior, and we need to fight against that as well.
Let me bring some comments in, because I want to change gears before we run. I got MCK Swift right in, who says rape culture doesn't belong to hip hop. FOH. It's the dominant culture in general that is a rape culture. FOH says hip hop culture doesn't exist in a vacuum. There are white execs and buyers of music that condone and promote this particularly grotesque form of misogyny. Nothing particular to blacks or hip hop culture. Emphatical says, when is Mark going to talk about the consumers of these types of music? Many consumers are females. I guess he means women, by the way. People produce what people consume. It's that simple. And of course, Speaking Response says, a man who sings about rape like that is evil, is disgusting. Jamila, I know you want to jump in.
Okay. First of all, water's wet. Women have been listening to rap music since day one. Okay. Like, there's always a guy who wants to hop up and act like he, you know, invented the wheel with that one. Like, oh, females listen to rap. Boom. That's it. You got your rape right there. It's all your fault. No, this is a type of music. This is a culture that has been sustained by men and women, by blacks and whites. But, you know, all that to say, if you want to talk to black people and young black males in particular, hip hop is a great way to start the conversation. So I can talk to a 19-year-old brother about rape culture using the Rick Ross line in a way that maybe if I just said, hey, did you hear about what happened in Steubenville? You know, it may resonate better with him if we start at the place of Rick Ross. Now, I'm not saying that that means that there's value in the line, and I'm glad that it happened, but that's the way in which rape culture is often being presented to our men and boys and our women and girls. So, no, it's not about saying that hip-hop is responsible for it or that it started there, but it lives there. So, no, we don't make excuses for it because rock has rape culture, or politicians can be pro-rape culture as well. This is our... You want to talk to our community? These are the things that are coming in and out of it.
There is a legitimate critique that says, look, we can't just look to the artist. There's production and there's consumption.
Absolutely.
And there's political economy around
it. It starts with the labels. It starts with the people who consume the music. It's all around
It's everywhere.
The world.
It's everywhere.
Want to
normalize that.
But putting any responsibility on the artist does not mean you're not putting any responsibility on the consumer. There's enough responsibility to go around.
You just heard a clip from a segment which took place on Huffington Post Live on April 1st, 2013, hosted by Mark Lamont Hill and featuring hip-hop artist Talib Kweli, Ebony Magazine's News and Life editor Jamila Lemieux, Washington Post columnist Rahel Tesfamerian, and activist Rosa Clemente. That is all the time we have for today. I'm Megan Murphy. Thanks for tuning in to Feminist Current. Feminist Current is a syndicated show produced by Megan Murphy out of Vancouver, BC, Canada. For more information on the show, please visit www.feministcurrent.com. If your station would like to air Feminist Current, you can find episodes at audioport.org or email us at info@feministcurrent.com.
You're listening to Bread and Roses. For those of you who tuned in to hear Delphine Crescenzo's interview with Lauren Kessler, author of Counterclockwise, I'm very sorry to say we cannot air that today due to technical difficulties. However, we have another excellent piece from WINGS, Women's International News Gathering Service. This one, Changing Zimbabwe. Speaking from her home in exile in Winnipeg, Hambira describes her work against the hideously failed land policy of the Mugabe government and why she had to flee. She still works on the child labor issue and hopes for the future.
Once upon a time, Zimbabwe was the breadbasket of Africa, but that breadbasket of Africa is no more.
Today on WINGS, Gertrude Hambira tells how farming was nearly destroyed by government policies in Zimbabwe, and how she was nearly destroyed as well.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to WINGS, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Our interviewer today is a collective member of Matrix, Canada's longest-running community radio women's program, which airs on Radio Centreville, Montreal. Here's Rosemarie Hawley.
Gertrude Hambira is a mother of five children and a grandmother of one. For the past 2 years, she's been living with her family in Winnipeg, where I recently interviewed her. In her home country, Zimbabwe, Gertrude Hambira was the general secretary of the largest trade union, the General Agricultural and Plantation Workers Union of Zimbabwe. Her union's opposition to the disastrous land reform program carried out by the ruling ZANU-PF party, the Zimbabwe African National Union Patriotic Front Party, headed by President Robert Mugabe, put her life in danger, and Gertrude was forced to flee the country in February of 2009. Here's her story.
Zimbabwe is situated in southern Africa. It is a landlocked country, neighbored by South Africa, Zambia, Mozambique, Malawi, and Botswana, and part of Namibia. We have the mighty Victoria Falls, the Kariba Dam, and it used to be an agro-based economy. Once upon a time, Zimbabwe was the breadbasket of Africa, but that breadbasket of Africa is no more.
Why?
If you are in a conflict situation and you allow the land to fail you, then that is the end of everything. Zimbabwe used to feed our neighbors, but nowadays we are having to beg from our neighboring countries because of the so-called land reform program, which was initiated in 2000 by the ZANU-PF regime. Before independence, we were colonized by the British. We got our independence after a long struggle of independence, which was bloodshed, really bad. After independence, it was lovely. We enjoyed our freedom for the first time. We could really feel it in the air that this is freedom. And we really had good hopes when our President Mugabe extended a reconciliation hand to the whites who had colonized us before and said we need to coexist and build this country together. Yes, we did journey together for a while up until early 90s when our labor movement, where I belonged, started to realize that things were going haywire within the government structures. That was the beginning of another second struggle.
What happened?
There was bad governance in terms of resources for developing the country, which were brought in by organizations such as IMF, the World Bank, and all. Those resources were not channeled to develop the communities. Some of them were actually channeled to individuals. And then there was also the war vets situation where they demanded payment for their participation in the liberation struggle when the money was no longer there. And then there was also the issue of payment compensating, getting the farms from the white commercial farmers, and the British government was actually compensating for that. And that compensation was misused as well. And now came the chaotic land reform program, whereby the white commercial farmers were actually forcibly moved from the farms they had occupied for so many years. And I would say that, yes, there was some imbalances between the black and white in terms of land allocation. And that imbalance had to be actually corrected. But the way it was done did not go on well with the entire citizens of Zimbabwe, because it only benefited the political elite.
The land was supposed to be divided up and shared more equally with the local population. And this took too long, didn't it? And people got impatient.
Yes, it did take long, and the government did not address it at the right time. Yet we had organizations, the labor movement, civic society, calling for an equitable land distribution. And also my organization also was calling for land to the landless, because my organization is made of people who migrated from neighboring countries during the colonial era. And they had not known of any other home apart from that farm. Farm workers were actually governed by what was known as the Master and Servant Act, which gave the right to fire and hire at the same time. So because your entire livelihood was actually attached to the farm, the employer, the white commercial farmers, would say, if you join the union, you go with the union. I don't want to see you here. Or if you stay here, I will take care of you. And thus increasing the rate of cheap labor, bondage, and exploitation. Until after we got our independence, that legislation was abolished. And then we had the Reconciliation Act, which embraced all the labor issues. And that Reconciliation Act also was repealed after some time. And we had the Labor Relations Act that gave more powers to trade unions to go and organize in the farms. But it was so difficult, very difficult, because farm workers have been so attached to their employer. All their working life, they have been told, this is your home. I will take care of you. You don't have to go anywhere. Getting them into the trade union was so tough. We had to do it through persuasion. We had to do it through educational programs. We had to find so many strategies. If we don't win them today, we'll just let them digest what it means to have freedom, to enjoy your rights. So it took so many years for the farm workers to be unionized.
These farm workers depended totally on the white employers for everything.
That's correct. Everything. If you look at all the basic necessities, they were all at the farm. There was a clinic, there was a school, not a very good school though, and the teachers from those schools were not trained at all. These were teachers drawn from the field. If you would know a little bit of ABCD, you would then be promoted to a teaching position. The children will go probably from grade 1 up to 2 or 3, and then into the field, cheap labor. I remember very well when I was growing up, we used to think that we were helping the mothers, our parents in the field, yet it was a source of cheap labor, child labor, and it's still even rife today in the agriculture sector because of the current situation. I grew up in Marondera, 40 kilometers from Harare. My parents used to work at a farm. The system was, our parents were given large tasks in the field. And for you to be paid for that task, you have to finish it by the end of the day. An individual who didn't finish that task, he or she would have to bring his family to assist. So school was not a priority, but to help the parents in the field so that at the end of the day they are paid, and then we can have bread on the table, we can have our staple food sata, and we can also probably have a little bit of clothing, not school. The priority was to get bread and butter on the table. So as I grew up, I really felt that this was really unfair for us. We are all confined in this vicious circle where you don't know what is happening in the outside world. So my parents strived to give me a little bit of education, which I did up to my grade 11, 12. And thereafter, I went back to the farms to say, oh, this is no good. Someone needs to expose this thing. Someone needs to speak out for the voiceless. And that's how I started up the struggle for the farm workers.
So then you got into the union movement?
Yes, I did get into the union movement. I worked for the clothing industry as a shop steward, and also decided that I think agriculture is the best place for me to be. So from a child laborer, I rose to a shop steward, to a union organizer, to an educator, to a child labor coordinator, to a gender coordinator, and finally I got the position of a general secretary in 2000 when the road was rough in the agriculture sector.
Can you tell us about the road?
Well, this is the chaotic road of the land reform grab. It was a no-hold, no-buzzhold. I would say, in fact, it was a do-or-die situation where the supporters of ZANU-PF, of Mugabe regime, will go at a farm, order a farmer to leave the farm there and there. They would say, we are giving you 3 hours, 2 hours, 1 hour to pack your particulars. And within an hour, you would only grab your family and leave the entire property, the entire what we have worked for so many years, and go nowhere. But what people didn't know from across the world was, yes, the farmer might leave the farm. And in Zimbabwe, farms are so big. Each employer, each farmer used to employ 50 to 200 people, 300, even 1,000. Farm work is labor intensive. And behind that one farmer, there are 200 people who are also being displaced. While the farmer was trying to make his getaway, even out of the country, to go to Australia, United Kingdom, Canada, America, there's no way he was going to take these 200 farm workers with him. They became displaced and destitute.
There was an awful lot of violence as well, wasn't there?
There was a lot of awful violence, gross human rights violations. The trade union, when these workers were being thrown out of the land, started to document all the gross human rights violations. They started to stretch their arm to start feeding these workers, to work with other NGOs to say, we don't have food, children have been pushed out of school, HIV/AIDS is not sparing us. As a trade union worker, trade unions are not there to negotiate wages only, working conditions. They look at the entire welfare of the worker. I remember very well my organization put up a school at one of the villages because we had children walking for about 20 kilometers a day to go to the nearest school. And the girl child was actually not finishing school. Along the way, she was abused. And we got funding from the Canadian government and we put up a block of school. But we now had these new settlers in that particular area saying, this school belongs to us. And then we had to say, no ways. This school belongs to the community. Every child has the right to go to school. And yes, the civic society, other NGOs started to chip in to help, but that help did not go a long route because they were stopped. The government said, leave them alone. Food, which was meant for farm workers, clothing, was confiscated as we went to deliver those food. So it was really a tough, tough situation. People were killed, farmers, farm workers, animals. It was really, really gross. If there's anyone who wants to see the documentary which I produced, House of Justice, because the world outside would see Zimbabwe as Mugabe is always correcting things, but the other side of violence was not even shown. So we took it upon ourselves as a union to say, I think the world needs to know these things, that this is not an issue of black and white. It is an issue of human rights violations.
So you made a film.
For you to be a part of your union, you have to go to the community and be part of them. When these things were happening, we were actually in the field. We used the mobile phones to do our shootings because there was no media allowed into the farms, let alone independent media.
Now, when the farmers are removed from the farms, these are the white farmers that have owned these farms sometimes for generations, who was taking over the farms?
A group of youth will be assigned to go and invade the farm. That doesn't mean that that farm will belong to that group of people. They are doing it on behalf of a high-ranking government official, a minister, an army commander, the president himself, and all other political elites, not a homeless person, not a landless person, including them. Once they've grabbed that farm, a certain minister will say, "This belongs to me. Can you go to the next one?" So you'll find that not only do they own single farms, but they own multiple farms.
And are they capable of actually farming?
Farming is not something you would say that this is my farm now and by tomorrow the field is green. It's a process. And that process can take a year or two or three. Had they wanted to be part of this process, they would have started small and then grow big and learn from the white commercial farmers and learn from the farm workers, because they had enough experience which they had developed over the years, expertise, knowledge. Despite that farm workers did not go to school, they knew what was crop rotation. They knew what type of fertilizer to apply on this crop. But that was all gone within a couple of days. It's so easy to destroy.
What's been the reaction of Zimbabwe's neighbors?
They've been, I would say, a toothless bulldog. We have turned to our neighbors, South Africa, everyone, the SADC community, but they failed to address the situation of Zimbabwe. Even the issue of immigration, because agriculture was the backbone of Zimbabwe. And then when that backbone was broken, all the industry did not function. Factories closed, and people went to South Africa, Botswana, Malawi, Zambia. And it's not rosy in South Africa. It's not rosy. And as the leadership in the neighboring countries see that happening, they never pointed a finger at him. They just looked. Because for them, it was the hero of Africa. He was taking land and giving it to the black. But which blacks? That's the question which remains unanswered up to now. Who benefited from the land reform program?
You are listening to Gertrude Humbira, a leading farm workers' labor leader from Zimbabwe, being interviewed from her home in exile in Canada.
I was called for interrogation by the high-ranking officials of the army, the police, the air force, the central intelligence, and I was highly interrogated and told that I need to be thrown into prison and be tortured into death. But what I did when I went for that interrogation, I took a human rights lawyer with me, my work colleagues, and that is what saved me. Because as we walked into the interrogation room, they said, "Look at her, she comes here with other people." Meaning that had I gone there on my own, we wouldn't be talking today. Knowing from past experience, those who have been called before that committee, that will be the end of their life. But already these guys, my colleagues, had already seen who was part of this structure which was interrogating me. So after about 3 hours, they let us go, and they said, "We are not done with you. We will call you again." 5 days later, they pounced on our office. Not the same structure, but a lower structure. I'm a woman of faith. Even when we go out into the field, we used to pray for God to be with us. to guide us, to protect us. We fast and pray. So on this particular day, when these other guys came to the office, my angel just told me, Gertrude, leave the office. Go and pick up your son from school. And I said, no, I can't leave the office. I still have other things to do. And I was told, just leave this office. And I left the office. So when I left the office, my colleague said, please, can you bring us some rolls and bread? We need to drink tea when you come back. I said, no problem. I went to the convenience store to buy bread. And then as I was walking to the office, my instinct, my angel tells me, don't go to the office. I said, why? I have bread here. We need to make tea. And then my instinct says, go and pick your son from school. And then I said, I still have an hour. And then I said, okay. I then went to school to pick my son. And you know, in Zimbabwe, because things are so bad, we usually, when we travel, when we are driving, you take your purse because you can be burglared and put it in the trunk. So that is where I put my purse and my mobile phone. And I drove to school and I parked my car. I waited for 30 minutes and then went to pick my son from the classroom. And I drove back. So as I was approaching home to drop my son, my conscience tells me, pull off the road. I pull off the road, and then my son said, why are you stopping? I said, well, I need to check on my phone. I take my phone, I look at my phone. There are more than 50 calls, all of them from the office. And then I said, oh, these guys, they are crazy. They want bread from me. And then I said, okay, let me try and call them back. So as I call them back, no one is speaking. Some of them have actually switched off their phones. And then eventually someone calls me and said, Gertrude, where are you? The office is under siege. Just leave the country right away. And then I said, so help me God. This is the day you have made. I then started trembling, shivering, to say, now where do I go? I'm here with my son, with my handbag, my purse. That is all I have. I had to gain my strength. I had to pray. And I gained my strength. I called one office to say, this is the situation. And then the world was alerted. And ZCTU was alerted. And they said, okay, wherever you are, just stop there. We are coming to get you. And then they came and picked me up. And then the first thing they asked me was, do you have your passport with you? Fortunately, I had spent 3 days looking for my passport in the house. And that very same morning, I said, oh, I need my passport. I might be traveling anytime soon. And I had put it in my purse. And then they said, okay, we'll take your son. We'll take care of him. And we are now working on a route for you to leave the country, because we don't want another bad situation. We are still recovering from the situation of Justina Mokoko, a very prominent human rights defender who was kidnapped and kept in secrecy for 21 days. And then they said, we are not going to have another second Justina Mokoko. You just have to leave the country. And there I was, leaving the country unceremoniously.
So you came to Canada?
I went to South Africa. I didn't have a Canadian visa. And when I was in South Africa is not a bed of roses for immigrants. You remember the issue of xenophobia? It's so tough. I was a lady of no fixed abode. I was emotionally distressed for 10 months. Despite that, I continued with my advocacy. I traveled to Europe, to the International Labour Organization, to many different organizations to say, this is the situation. But at the same time, I went to the United Nations in South Africa to say, this is my situation, I'm under surveillance. And the UN says, we know about your situation, but you just have to go through the processes. There are lots of refugees here. And going through that process meant I was going to be in South Africa for more than 2, 3, 4, 5 years, being of no fixed abode. Nevertheless, I had a United States visa, and my daughter was already here. She came here to do a master's degree in food science under the scholarship of Rotary International. So she said, "Mom, you just have to leave South Africa. I can't stay there." I said, "I can't. What about my children?" Eventually, she said, "We will work out something. We have lots of people here who are going to help you to get out of South Africa." So eventually, the guys here from the Rotary International engaged a human rights lawyer here, and other lawyers put their wisdom together, and they said, if she has a United States visa, let her go to the United States, and then she can cross through the Niagara and declare refugee. And that's what I did. But at the back of my mind, I said, "Oh Lord, what about these three children?" There was the 6-year-old, a 13-year-old, and a 15-year-old.
So how did you get your children here?
I had to get them back from South Africa to Zimbabwe. They were being under the custodian of my church friends. And as we were working on my refugee claim here, a petition was put down to go to the immigration minister to say we need to get these children out of Zimbabwe like yesterday. And yeah, it worked on very well. Eventually, after a year, a project was put by the Rotary Club, and they got the children out of Africa. In fact, one of the Rotarians volunteered, because these are the children who had never traveled abroad, volunteered to go and meet them in South Africa and bring them here. So I'm really grateful.
So how long have you been here now, Gertrude?
Two and a half years now, yes.
And you're continuing with your work?
I continue with my work. Only 2 days ago, I was addressing a May Day gathering, and then we had a very wonderful march despite the cold. The issue of child labor is really a pain for me, because right now I'm here in Canada and my children have all good opportunities, but I still have a guilty conscience to say, what about those children I left back? 2 days ago, I received a text message from a colleague.